All right. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, buddy. Nice to be here.
So we'll start off where everyone does. As far as earliest childhood memories, what are we getting into?
Yeah. Well, so I was prepared for this because I did my homework. But I was actually, it's funny because, you know, I'm a photographer and a filmmaker. And I was thinking, like, what is my earliest childhood memory? And then I'm thinking, like, I actually don't know because my family, my dad was a photographer.
Okay.
My family, I grew up with a handy cam. Like we, or not, maybe not a handy, we had a video camera, like since I was like a small child,
yeah,
slash at least a stills camera. Mm-hmm. So my memories are all mixed up between photographs and video and real memories. Gotcha. You know what I mean? So, but one of the earliest ones for sure. I know one person mentioned this not recently, being on the ice, like being on the rink. And okay. I that's one that sticks out for me, you know, cause we had a hockey rink. Like I'm Canadian. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a rink across my street.
Yeah.
And as we do, and, I learned to skate before I could run. So, okay. You know, there's a picture of me. I'm like, under two put, like, wow. You know, like on the rink skating, whatever. So I think that's like the earliest one for me, that I can really remember.
Absolutely. So as a Canadian, was it from your mom's side, dad's side? What got you on the ice?
Both. My whole family, really. Like, so I'm a big big hockey fan, big Bruins fan, even though I live close to Toronto. So, you know, okay. Things get hairy. but as you can imagine. But yeah, so not far from where I grew up, about 2 hours from where I grew up, Bobby Orr grew up. And
okay.
Parry Sound. I'm from Sudbury. Parry Sound's not far from there. And for anyone who doesn't know, Bobby Orr is, you know, a legendary defenseman. So they basically were Bruins fans because of him. And then I was almost, you know, brainwashed, basically. Not almost, I was, to be a Bruins fan. But, you know, they were the ones that got me on the ice at an early age. And I was lucky enough to play rep hockey my whole childhood and everything. So yeah, it was awesome to get out there so early, and that's all I really knew. Yeah, that's all I wanted to do when I was a kid, was play hockey.
So
it's so cliche Canadian, I guess.
I actually have cousins that live in Toronto, and same for him. They had a little like knee hockey thing in their basement if they couldn't go outside and play, and right. if they could go outside, right. they were playing on the ice.
That's it.
As far as like school went, was it, hey, I'm just going to school so that afterwards I can go play hockey? Or did you like that as far as like elementary, middle school?
So you mean like, what do you mean? Sorry, ask that again.
I'll ask a better question. Did you enjoy academics at all? Or was it just hanging out with your friends?
Okay. Did I enjoy school? You know, so yeah, school was definitely for me, like gym class was like, I was just waiting for gym class basically. Mm-hmm. So like, I sound like a jock, and I wasn't really, but, I just couldn't wait for recess. Couldn't wait for gym class. Couldn't wait for after school when, you know, we were doing sports or whatever. So
yeah
like academics weren't, I was a good student. Like only because I was a people pleaser. So, and I didn't want to disappoint my parents. So
yeah,
like that was the real reason. And then I took, my biggest academic sort of achievement, I guess, was I took piano, my whole childhood up until, nice. And I taught actually, even when I was in high school, up until I was in grade, 10 or 11. And I got my like grade 8 conservatory. And then I was like, this is too much. I can't handle all this shit. So I kind of quit, switched to guitar or whatever. But that, so a lot of my, a lot of my like academic achievements, I guess, or like my focus was on extracurricular, you know,
right.
music outside of school and hockey outside of school. And then I guess hockey's not academic, but you know, it was always like, yeah, as some would say. So, like school was, it got in the way for me, yeah. really. Because it was just a time killer and it wasn't really what I wanted to be doing. Like, you know, that's the same old story, but.
As far as being a people pleaser and like, didn't want to disappoint your parents, was that something that they had instilled with you that said like, hey, you need to do well, or is just more of like a feeling of that you needed to do well?
It was, it's a good question. It is by nature, for sure. It wasn't, yeah, I don't think it was really coming from them. I'm sure there was some influence there, obviously, but you know, there was never a time when I got a really bad grade or something, and then there was like a spanking or something. Like that's not what happened. It was just, I don't know. I always had, right from an early age, I remember, you know, back to childhood memories. I remember my dad would ask me like, do you want to go to the, you want to go to the store with me? I was like three. You want to go to the store with me? You want to go to the bank with me? Whatever. And I was like, I didn't want to, but I said yes. You know, yeah. I was that kid. So even when I was like three, so it was just, I don't know. It's by nature.
it was in the blood,
I guess. Yeah.
Remember, I think my downfall of like people pleasing in school was fifth grade. I got a C, and it was like my first C ever. And I thought my mom was going to be disappointed. I thought she was going to scold me and stuff like that. I thought I was going to be held back. Like I flunked, and she's like, oh no, like that's fine. And I was like, C's are okay. this is
what great.
Like people usually when they get into high school are they're like, oh well, like grades don't matter. Like I hit that as soon as we got to middle school.
Yeah. I feel you there for sure. I don't know where it all came from. What, like, where did your fear of, you know, failure come from, or disappointing?
Like for me, it was 100% I made assumptions of what people would think. So yeah. Like that school one, like I was super scared. Like if I didn't get like an A, that it was going to be an issue. And like I was a killer student in elementary school just because like I was focused. I had this thing looming over my head. And then when I got to middle school and it wasn't I wasn't scared anymore. There wasn't that I needed to stay tight on this. It was like that motivation just went away a little bit.
Yep. I get that too, for sure. I feel you.
As far as hockey goes, obviously there's a bunch of different levels and I kind of compare it to gymnastics here in the States, where everyone is going to the Olympics. That's just, you start here, you work your way up. That's what everyone needs to do.
Right.
What was it like starting off as a young kid for yourself?
Yeah, that was interesting. So like it's different now. I'm 36. So when I was younger, there wasn't as much of the like, you know, mold your kid into being a superstar mentality, at least where I grew up. So I grew up in Sudbury, which is about 4 hours north of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And we were like dominant in Sudbury. Like no one touched us. Like we were the highest level, you know, in terms of like, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but we have like single A, double A, triple A.
Okay.
And so we were like the AAA team of Sudbury. But then when we would travel south and to Toronto, we would just get destroyed. The guys were just dancing around us. And it was that case of, you just didn't, if you don't have the competition, how are you going to get better? When you're the best out there, how are you going? I'm not saying I was the best player on the team, but you know, just the team in general, we were just dominant. So and then if you don't practice against those people all the time, how are you going to get better? So that's why, you know, a lot of in areas like that, in areas like Sudbury, parents will take their kids and put them in like 2 years up so that you know, they can get that competition, because otherwise they're just going to plateau and they're not going to keep up. Right. So, so yeah, in terms of the actual, plus on top of that, personally, I'm only like 5'6", 5'6.5" on a good day.
Yeah.
So if I do my stretches, so, you know, like it was very clear to me early on that, it wasn't a career option for me just because I was too small. And if I were that size, I was also a defenseman, it's even harder. So, so I have a soft spot actually, for like when I see guys like Torrey Krug and these small defensemen in the NHL, like, you know, holding their own. I'm like, I love those guys because it you know, it hits home for me. But yeah, in terms of like making a push, I never really did. And then I actually, once I moved, my family ended up moving out to Niagara Falls area.
Okay.
And, the hockey was not as good. It was just not what I wasn't liking it. And then I actually took a pretty bad head injury and I got hit a couple times and, you know, my mom sort of encouraged me to quit, but yeah, you know, it was definitely a push. So I ended up quitting earlier than I wanted to, which was a bit of a bummer, but you know, as I get older, I think I do appreciate that advice because, you know, too many head injuries at that age would not be a good thing.
Kind of hard to come back from getting hit in the head too many times. You just see people that it's like, oh yeah, when we opened it up, that CTE was pretty bad. And it's like, how many hits was it? Like, is it the first one, the fifth one? Like, it's tough to know.
Yeah. And that's a big thing with hockey, right? They've improved it in the game, but the game's only gotten faster. So, you know, I even have to be like, if I play men's league now and I play like in a higher tier men's league, I can't go out there and just like have a leisurely good time. Like I have to be on, like, you know, sometimes I'm tired. Like usually with the men's league, as you probably know, it's like late night. Sometimes we get on the ice at 10 o'clock. I'm like half asleep. That's like my bedtime. And I'm like dozing around on the ice. And then before you know it, like a guy's coming in, like, you know, hot at you. So yeah, you got to keep your head up. And it's like, nothing has changed for me in that way too. Mm-hmm. The speed that is in the NHL has definitely carried over to like men's league and higher end men's leagues because the gear has gotten so good. The sticks are so light. They're so good. The skates are so light. So everything's gotten faster, not just in, you know, the NHL. So
yeah, it's interesting because like most sports, as you get into the higher level, like it gets more dangerous because of impact and stuff like that. But for rugby, I played that for a couple of years, and I dabble every once in a while when the wife allows me.
Doesn't seem like a dabble kind of sport.
So like I'll go to practices, and then they're like, hey, like you want to go play in this tournament or whatever it is. And this was right before our wedding in 2019. And she's like, no, you can't have your face wrecked for our wedding.
Oh yeah. True. That's fair. I'll give her that one.
It's like, all right. Understandable.
Like you could have wore like a helmet, I guess. Yeah. But that's not it. Very rugby. Wouldn't be very rugby of you.
No. But well, so actually funny enough, when I first started, I had one of those on, but I was a wing. So it didn't matter. Like it doesn't, it wasn't helpful.
Got it.
But as you get up into the higher levels, there's less and less injury because when you tackle someone, you're not throwing your head into it. You're using proper technique and things of that nature. But I have some friends that had played in the higher levels before, and they don't like to play at the lower levels because you have kids that really haven't played before.
Yep.
They're landing on your ankles, your knees are just it doesn't work out great.
I can imagine.
At what age did you move to Niagara, and like what level hockey were you playing then?
I was about 13 when we moved, so, which sounds young, but really like when I was in Sudbury, I was literally on the ice 6 days a week, sometimes twice. So my life was hockey. It was no joke.
So run me through a day that you're on two days or two times a day.
Well, actually, so some weekends, like if we did a tournament on a weekend, it would be 2 days of two games a day. So it'd be like on Friday, we'd have two games. On Saturday, we'd have two games. And then on Sunday, you could have two games on Sunday, but usually the Sunday, like Sunday was the championship sort of Sunday, right? With all the final games. But typically, you know, just like a regular day would have been 2 hours of practice. And we had like drill sergeant coaches. Like we didn't, there was not a puck on the ice for the first hour. I'm not even kidding. So, oh yeah, it was skating, man. My legs must have been gigantic. Like if I were to bulk up and just eat, you know, chicken breast or something, I would have had giant quads probably. But I was an absolute monster. All of us were skating wise. Right. So that was the funny thing. Like we could keep up with the skating, the skill level with the skating and the speed, but actually the puck handling and everything, once we got out to Toronto, that was the difference. So,
gotcha.
But yeah, it was like 6 days a week, 2 hour practices. You know, sometimes I'd have to go to arenas like in the middle of the winter. It was an hour away. We'd take a bus and there was like no, it sounds silly because it's a ice rink, but no heat at all. So you're talking like Northern Ontario, it's like minus 35 and it's cold. So we would like put like you know, socks, hockey socks on our heads and then put our helmet on kind of thing. It was chaos, but yeah, so it was just like, yeah, a lot of either sometimes we do the two games a day, but, you know, 2 hours a day practice. It was crazy.
So if you have two games, say we're going to a tournament, what are you eating in that day just to keep enough energy?
That's what's funny about it. Like, I don't even remember because I was a kid. So I never really took it seriously. And then once I moved to Niagara, I didn't really take it seriously at all. Yeah. I understand nutrition a little bit better, but I was still young enough that my mom was just like, you got to eat, like eat this kind of thing. Right. So, I didn't really care about the nutrition. I just wanted to play hockey. Like I was thinking about this, the childhood memory thing, like I said, and I do have it's not my earliest one, but I have a memory of like, this is how hardcore I was. It's almost embarrassing. I got the flu as a kid and, I wanted to prove to my mom that I could not go to the game. I just wanted to go to the practice. Like that's how much I loved hockey. Like I was like, get me to the practice. I don't care. I was like, if I can run up and down these stairs, I'll show you that I'm okay. I'll run up and down these stairs. And we're not talking, there wasn't like a long, big flight of stairs. It was like 10, 15 steps. I ran down, I ran up, and then immediately threw up. So it was like, I clearly was not fit. So it was like, my mom was like, see, there you go. Like, that's what's going to happen on the ice if you go. But yeah, that was one memory I had. I think I was like 8 or something.
Fantastic. So when you weren't playing hockey and you were at home, was there ever like a conversation around, hey, these are healthy foods, these are good foods? What was that like at home?
Yeah, that's interesting. My mom didn't eat meat when we were growing up because she actually got a stomach. I don't know what she ended up contracting, but she got food poisoning at some point. And then it like actually permanently messed with her stomach. So she learned that she couldn't have beef or chicken. She could have fish still. But that was kind of it. So, you know, she would cook for us and it was a lot of like casserole-y type of stuff and stuff that she could cook quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, God bless her. Like, I think about it, I'm like, man, she had to cook for two people or like two families, like herself and the family. But in terms of nutrition and stuff like that, didn't know a whole lot, but really didn't need to. Like, I don't mean to say that like you shouldn't know nutrition, but I was so active as a kid that, you know, it didn't really matter. Like you could have sworn, like, because I'm not like an energetic person, like you wouldn't see me and be like, oh, this guy, yeah, of course he did all that. No, I'm sedentary typically, but then when you put a ball in front of me, I'm gone. Or like anything, like when I was a kid, I was on my bike all the time. Like I was burning calories nonstop. So, so you could just put anything in front of me. I couldn't put on weight. I really couldn't.
Yeah.
And that actually, it's funny, that actually followed me throughout my life until, I think it was last year. I was running at about 135 pounds. So I'm like 5'6", 5'7".
Okay.
It was really lean. I didn't realize how lean that was. My doctor told me years ago, like, you got to put on some fat, like you need to put on some weight. Like if you get sick, you got no reserves, like that type of thing. And it was only until last year, April last year, that I actually counted my calories in one day. And I think I eat a lot, you know?
Yeah.
I counted my calories. I'm like, I need to eat more. Like, this isn't enough. Like, no wonder I can't put on any weight anyway. So I think my point is, I think that my metabolism was so fast and furious when I was a kid that it followed me into adulthood, into my mid 30s. So I think it's slowing down now. I don't know if that's paired with my current level of activity and food intake and all that, but so I think my crazy childhood, my metabolism just carried over somehow. Does that make sense? Maybe, you know.
Well, so there was, I want to say it was the New York Times, but there's been a couple of multiple studies lately that it's about every year you lose about 25 calories off your metabolism. So a lot of it has to do with lifestyle. Okay. But I also have a buddy that his wife, I tell this story quite often, but she has her master's in dietetics now. And he's about 6 foot, 155, soaking wet. And she was having him eat anywhere from 8 to 10,000 calories a day to have him gain some weight.
Wow.
And he'd maybe gain like 1 to 3 pounds, but then like he'd get tired of eating that much, and then he'd get back down to 155. But
that's a lot of work to eat that much. That's insane. Like, what was like? That's crazy. That's a lot of activity.
A lot of it was milkshakes and just like sucralose and a bunch of carbs in there and stuff like that, just to add in a ridiculous amount of calories.
But, yeah.
He'll put down a double wrapped Chipotle burrito pretty easily.
That's insane. That's a lot of a lot of intake.
A lot of intake.
You look at like I mean I don't know if you've seen The Rock's Dwayne Johnson's cod intake.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he eats like a 20 cod a day or something. It's absurd.
That's got to be uncomfortable.
It's not even fun, and he doesn't even. It's not even seasoned or anything. Yeah. It's like he's an animal. I'm like, dude, I don't know. It doesn't look fun to me. And that's something that I don't know. I don't have that drive. There's nothing in me. Like I just signed up for soccer, actually, like men's soccer league for the first time. I haven't played soccer since high school.
Yeah.
And I'm like thinking about like, oh man, what do I need to do to like get prepared for this? And would I eat 20 cod a day to do so? Like, no. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not The Rock, obviously, but you know, I'm willing to sacrifice in my life to make myself better at certain things. And part of that is my job. Like, I like to stay active. I like to stay fit for my job because I have to carry on big, heavy cameras and stuff like that sometimes. And, and then when a sport, something comes up, like hockey season's coming up, I love the excuse to like start training, you know?
Yeah.
Get my fitness going, get my my eating habits are pretty good anyway, typically. So
as far as your eating habits go, like when you were growing up, would you say you had a healthy relationship with food, or what was going on there?
Yeah. Yeah, a healthy relationship for sure. Like we snacked, you know, my parents would stock the, you know, we would have Pepsi in the fridge and we would have passion flakes or something like that around. But I would actually have one a day. So I was always, I don't know if that must have been taught to me by my parents. They were like, you can have one, like that's it. And I listened. So yeah, the relationship was definitely healthy in that way. And then, you know, I grew up with my grandma and my baba, who's Ukrainian, and my grandma's Irish, but my grandma makes tons of food, like pie and like everything you can imagine. Definitely would indulge when I'd go there. And then my baba is, like I said, Ukrainian. So lots of pierogies and peta has the same thing, cabbage rolls, all that stuff. That was just like, that was my childhood in terms of food, but I always had a healthy, I felt for the longest time, felt uncomfortable eating too much, like to the point where I would almost like want to throw up. So
yeah,
you know, I didn't like getting to that point until I was older and I like understood like, oh, sometimes when you go out to dinner with people, you eat too much and then you need to be able to handle your shit because you don't want to be like, I got to go, or like puke at the table. So
yeah.
So I learned that, but healthy relationship with food for sure.
That's fantastic. So when we're going through high school, we're not playing hockey as seriously anymore. What's going through our mind as far as like, what path are we wanting to take?
You're talking maybe like later stages of high school when you're starting to think where you want to do, what you want to do with your life and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, it was exactly what I'm doing right now. So I was lucky enough to have what they called a communications technology program in my high school, which was the short form was ComTech. So I had this ComTech class and it was the most amazing class you could ever imagine for someone like myself. They bought a bunch of computers. They bought some cameras, handy cams and shit, not anything special. And they actually, by the end they did upgrade, but anyway, they put Premiere on it, like the first ever Adobe Premiere. Like it was insanely slow. Like it would take, not even kidding, it would take like 3 hours to zoom in, do a zoom in on a photo. I'm not kidding. Like painstaking. Like we would sleep over. And so that was where my passion, it was very clear that okay. that's where my passion was. And like I said, I grew up with cameras and stuff my whole life, but I was the kid. I don't know if you ever remember the kid in class. It would be like, okay, everyone get up, do your presentation. I was like, yeah, I made a video. Like, you know,
we didn't
you
remember, have any of those. That's
didn't great. Have any of those kids. Yeah, I was that kid. I would like try to like make sure the teacher would get the TV in and all that stuff. So that was always me. So and then when I think back, I'm like, yeah, that was just in that was in me the whole time. So
yeah.
So I kind of knew that was my sort of my path. And then, you know, my parents divorced when I was 16 and things got a little, I got off the rails for sure for a little while. Mm-hmm. Really didn't do well in my grade 12th grade. I think you guys put the number first. We go grade 12.
Yeah. I don't know what we do over here anymore.
Okay. So it's not that crazy, but, my first year of grade 12, I shit the bed. Yeah. And that's the big year that you need to get into school and everything, obviously, right? So I went back, I redid my grade 12 and actually tried. And then I ended up going to school for film and television. And
okay, so, if you don't mind, when your parents got divorced, what is something that you would have liked to hear from either somebody else or even if you had to tell yourself now, what would have you liked to hear?
I think it would be... So my family was very like, we were like the perfect family in the sense that my mom always invited my friends over, always like threw parties for me, like bring 20 people over. Cause we, you know, especially cause we moved to a new area, she really wanted me to make friends.
Yeah.
So we were like the perfect family. Like that's what it kind of looked like. And then things changed very quickly. Like for me, they changed quickly. I'm sure for them, it was not that quick, you know?
Right.
And I think the big thing that I would tell myself is it's not, life isn't that serious. You know, it's not as serious as this may seem right now.
Right.
When you're 30 or when you're whatever, you're going to look back at this and think, yeah, I put too much weight into that. Mm-hmm. And it was strange though, because we were a tight family unit, but it was our extended family that was so tight, especially on my mom's side, which we never really lost that. But, I was really taught family comes first and it still does for me always. But with that, I really neglected my own self.
Okay.
And, so that's something that I would really like to, tell my younger self is that there's going to be a point in your life where you're going to understand that you can only take care of everyone for so long until you realize you have to take care of yourself and you can't neglect yourself. So when my parents divorced, I really took it upon myself to like take care of them individually.
Yeah.
Which sounds backwards. You would think that they would take care of the kids, which they did too. But I really took on that role of like, make sure dad's okay, make sure mom's okay, because they don't have each other anymore. They don't have anyone anymore, you know? So I put a lot on myself and I continued to do that into my 20s, even into my 30s. And then at some point I hit a wall, you know? I think that's the big thing. That I think back and think like, oh yeah, I neglected Quinn. You know, Quinn needs to take care of himself first before he can take care of others. You know, it's that whole thing. It sounds cliche, but it's true. Like, you know, you got to put your whatever that thing is when the plane's going down. You put that shit on for your mask.
Yeah. They say
put
it
yours
all the
on
time,
first,
every
and
time.
It's I know it's cliche and dumb, but like it's true. It is, and that does apply to life. It does for me at least too. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think similar life lessons are hard to come by somebody else telling you like, oh, hey, that stove is hot. Nah, it's not going to be that hot. And then you learn for yourself. So do you think you would be the person you are today without having that experience?
Without the divorce?
Yeah.
In that? I would be different, I think, for sure. I learned some independence, I think, early on from that in a way. Mm-hmm. Not because, like, I lived with my dad well, I, you know, we went back and forth for a while. And then when I was going to college, I lived with my dad. And so I wasn't necessarily independent in that way, but I learned a lot about, you know, because when your parents are together, that you know them as a couple, you know them as a unit.
Right.
And then you see them all of a sudden live like their own lives. Mm-hmm. So I almost got to see that. Like, that was interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely contributed to my growth and like becoming an adult and all that stuff. Seeing them not only lose something like that, but seeing them go from like always a unit to, like I said, being an individual, doing their own thing, having to figure life out again, right. Having to figure life out for themselves, like solo, you know, maybe for the first time, because they got married when they were fairly young, not crazy yeah. young, but young enough. So, so I think it gave me some insight into like adulthood, and it gave me some insight into how should I treat my wife and how should I like, not to say my dad treated my mom poorly and stuff like that, it was like fine, but you know, it didn't work out obviously. Right. So there were things that went wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of learning that happens there. And I don't know, I didn't take, like, I guess people could say like, you know, the abused becomes the abuser, that type of mentality. It didn't happen for me. And maybe everyone takes something differently away from an experience like that. But mm-hmm. I to answer your question, like I definitely don't think I would be the same person today with yeah. if my family unit was still intact.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. When my parents got divorced, like up until like sixth, seventh grade, I saw them as these superheroes and valuable
yes.
creatures.
Yes.
And then when I saw them living alone, like my mom would burn food and like she would just space out or whatever it is. And like now today as a parent, I'm like, we're just people.
Exactly.
like there is definitely a high standard, but it's nice to see more or less that they are human. It is real.
Yes.
And it more or less it's okay.
That's exactly what I was thinking earlier. Like you see that no one has shit figured out. Like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one of those things I would tell my younger self, that 16-year-old Quinn, when my parents got divorced, is like, they don't have shit figured out, and they yeah. never did. And no one does, you know, and cause I think that, I was like you, I looked up to my parents. I looked up to the people that were, you know, my adult figures that in my life, and, thinking that they did have it all figured out. And I also got a lot of, like, I would ask questions a lot when I was a kid, and I got a lot of, oh, you're too young. Like, you know, you'll learn when you're older. You'll learn when gotcha. You're older. You'll learn. Like I heard that my whole childhood, not just from my parents, like from everyone. And I think that made me want to become an adult. Like mm-hmm. really, like I wanted to know these things. Like I wanted to drive. I wanted to do all the adult things. Mm-hmm. And so I pushed myself into adulthood like early. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And I think I really had a false sense of, even up until I think I was about 30, I think I still thought like, oh, there's got to be like people know what's good. Like they got it figured out, right? Like for sure. Like once I reach this age, no. And now I've just accepted that no one knows what the fuck is going on. Like everyone. And I think that the pandemic has shown us that very thing. Like,
yeah.
No, no one knows jack shit. Like it's a free for all out there.
I think that's why old people are so happy, because they know it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. No one, yeah. no one really cares what you're doing or what you say or what, like it's fine. It doesn't matter.
That's it. I think that's it. Like you go so many years, and actually I was saying that to a couple friends last week. We were like chatting, and we were chatting about small talk and how like we hate small talk. Like I don't know if it's an age thing or whatever. Like I say age thing, I'm mid 30s, but
yeah.
I was saying like, we've said the same thing to like 1,000 different people 1,000 times. And I was like, I think that's why old people just don't talk a lot. It's like, I've done this shit, man. I've done it. I don't need to do it again. You know, they're more content just sitting there chilling.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually whenever I meet someone new, I try to stay away from the what do you do for work thing. I'm like, hey, like, what do you love to do? Like, what do you like to do? And there's always a pause. They're like,
didn't expect that one.
Wasn't ready for this question. And like, I hear myself right as I'm about to say, oh, what do you do for nope.
Yeah, I
take a pause.
Hey, kudos to you, man. We need more people like you asking those questions.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, when I was working, this podcast thing was in the making, because whatever my job was at the time, I was always talking to somebody else, whether it was part of my job or not part of my job. I was talking and asking way too many questions.
Right. Hey, and that's okay too. And actually, in this setting, like, I like it to be a conversation. Like, I don't like talking about myself. Like, it sounds strange. Like, I put myself out there and share my knowledge and all that stuff, but I'm not an attention seeking person. Typically I do it because I feel like I need to, and also because I like it. Like, I like sharing knowledge and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm perfectly fine. If you want to talk about yourself for a little while, that's cool with me, man.
if a story comes up, I'll jump in.
Okay. There. Sweet.
When you mentioned the playing piano, I played for about 2 years, and I was okay, but I would just memorize the notes and stuff like that, and then I'd go see the teacher.
Yeah.
And then after 2 years, he's like, okay, here's like a new song, because usually be like, hey, this is what I want you to learn for next week. I'd come in, I'd memorize and just play it. But this time he brought out some sheet music. He's like, okay, play this. And I'm like, A, or I don't even remember notes anymore. Like, so I didn't know how to read music and play at the same time.
Right. Did you like play, how long ago was this, by the way?
This would have been in elementary school.
So like YouTube and stuff didn't exist, and
no,
none of that. Because I was going to ask, did you have like a CD or something? That's going to age us, but did you have a CD that you could play that you would like learn? That's how the song goes. And then they emulate it.
They did have like the book and the CD, but the CD. I had my mom with me, and we would write the notes above it.
Okay.
And then I would get the first part, and then I'd get the next one. And yeah, after 2 years, and he's like, you can't read music and play. He's like, you're gone.
He fired you as a student?
Yeah.
What?
It was a good time. I was like, oh, okay.
I would have been impressed. Also, he's not doing his job if he only figured that out after 2 years.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, it was, I would show up, this is the music for next week, show me what you learned this week. Hey, you did a great job.
That's crazy. Good for you, man. You kept that streak going.
Yeah, hey, I enjoyed it. But so awesome. As you're in 12th grade, you repeated it. Now I know your schooling is a little bit different than ours. Did you have to take X amount of certain classes, or were you allowed to jump right into photography and stuff like that?
Yeah, I had to take X amount. Like, so in order to apply, the way that it works, at least the way it used to work, and I think it's still the same now. That's a long time ago. But anyway, that's like almost 20 years ago now, which is crazy. But it was basically like they had... I forget what the terms were, but it was basically like a university and a college.
Yep.
Like, you know, so if you wanted to apply to university, you had to take these. And if you wanted to only apply to college, because college is for dumb kids, then you can take the dumber classes. That's the way it was presented. So I took the college classes because I knew that I was a hands-on learner, and I knew I wasn't going to university. I knew what I wanted to do. Yeah. Even if I didn't end up going into film school, I wanted to do something in a college setting. I wasn't a university kid. I just knew that. I wasn't a book learning kid. I was a learn by doing kid. So I just took what I needed to in that grade 12. We had a guidance counselor that would, like, you know, inevitably try to guide you into a safer path.
Yeah.
And it was like, actually, as long as you wanted to go to school, they were cool with that. Like, okay. You know, that was safe. That was safe enough for them. If I were to say like, oh, I'm going to just become a photographer. I'm going to freelance out of high school. They'd been like, what is wrong with you? You know? So like, so I just took all the required, courses, and then, I did well enough. And I believe that my cover letter and the application to Niagara College was likely what got me in. You know, I don't think it was my amazing grades. Like, they were fine, but you know, I it was clear that I had a passion there. Right. And I hope they don't regret that I ended up being one of the better students in the college too. So I don't think they regretted the decision, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
So what made you such a good student there, as beforehand you were like, hey, I'm just doing this school stuff to go out afterwards?
Yeah, it was basically, I applied myself. I had a passion for it. Mm-hmm. And it was very clear in high school that I did well in the courses, in the classes that I had a passion for as well, which is not uncommon, obviously. But yeah, it was just clear that, you know, I found the areas that I enjoyed. I found the areas I was good at. And I worked at them, you know, and even by the time third year, approached, I think it was coming into third year, the school hired me to do some work. So it was, nice. It was recognized, like my teachers recognized that I had that potential there. So, yeah, I don't know. I also did treat it like a job. Like, I treated it, I went in as a professional, you know. I didn't really I became friends with the teachers and stuff. But I treated it as if I was in the industry already, which I think helped.
So how does one improve their skill other than just a mass amount of time spent at that skill?
That would have been my answer, to be honest. The right teacher helps. Okay. I really think that, you know, let's put it this way. Time spent learning to me is much different than time spent doing.
Okay.
So you could put me in a classroom for 1,000 hours. Probably not going to learn a whole lot.
Yeah.
Give me a task for 1,000 hours. And I'll learn a ton. I'll be an expert at it after that 1,000 hours, you know? So that's a big distinction. The way that you're taught, the way that someone teaches, may teach you is will definitely affect how you learn, how quickly you learn. Yesterday, I just had an intern student working with me for the past month, and she just finished a film program.
Okay.
And she is still not 100% confident behind a camera, still not 100%, like, composition, everything fine, the knowing what settings to use and everything, still not 100%. And so I said, okay, you know what, let's spend a couple hours on your last day and we'll just go through everything that you want to learn and that you're not 100% confident with yet. And we sat down. I could tell right away what was clicking with her and what wasn't. And I taught her photography and I taught her film in how to use a camera in a way that she never heard before. And in 2 hours, it clicked. Like, it was like night and day for her. So that's another thing. Like, it's the teaching method, understanding that, you know, not every kid, not every person learns the same way.
Right.
You know, I was terrible at math. And not due to a lack of applying myself. I just didn't get it. I just didn't understand. I didn't understand in the way that they were teaching it. I don't know what it was. I really couldn't wrap my head around some of the stuff. And I see that in some, you know, because I teach photography. I see that in some students. I can almost see the wheels spinning, like in a bad way. Like, just too much. It's too chaotic. And it reminds me of math. It reminds me of math class when I was a kid. And I see that, I'm like, uh-oh, I can pinpoint that. Yeah. And I'm not talking about kids, I'm talking about adults, you know?
Right.
So I can definitely see that. So just knowing, like, it's important for teachers to see that and acknowledge it and change the method a little bit. But also I understand that not every teacher has the ability to do that one-on-one thing,
right?
You know, because I usually deal with smaller classrooms if I'm teaching, so that's that's nice for me, you know.
So when the school hired you to work for them while you were in school, what was the job that they hired you for?
Yeah, it was basically they wanted to do a promotional video to get students excited about applying to the school.
Ooh, some of those are pretty bad.
Yes, they are. So luckily for me, it was like they wanted me to cover the... You're definitely right. They wanted me to cover like... They had what do they call that? Frosh week or whatever. The first week where there was like events happening. They had bands playing, all the hype and the excitement. So there was a day where they had like a couple of pop, like famous Canadian bands come. And so I filmed that and I filmed like kids getting excited and, you know, all that stuff. And then put together a kind of a montage, like a sizzly montage video. So it was pretty basic. Luckily. So yeah, so it was like stuff like that, which was neat, like, you know, to be asked to do that or whatever. And then funny enough, right once I graduated, I was trying to decide what to do. I knew that I was like pretty set on like starting my own company and freelancing and stuff. And then the school like messages me again and they're like, yeah, we want to do we want you to go up in a helicopter over Niagara Falls. And like, so I ended up like right out of school, still one of the coolest jobs I've ever done. I've been graduated like 14, 15 years ago. Not that, 2009. So like 13 years ago. And it's still one of the coolest things I've ever done. They had the door open. They strapped me in. They strapped in the camera so that it wouldn't, like if I dropped it, it would not crash into the falls. And strapped me in and then opened the friggin' door. And, you know, the wind's blowing. It was crazy, man. It was so cool. So that was another really cool experience I got from the college, and it was from their marketing department and the whole thing. But just goes to show, like, you know, I treated school, like I said, I treated that like I was in the industry already, and they treated me like I was in the industry already in a way, you know?
So when you're going up there, do you have one pass? Like what was the scenario?
Yeah, we were like, it was pretty neat. Like we had the headset on or whatever. So we could really request whatever we wanted, which was neat. Yeah. It was pretty cool. So if we said, oh, can we like fly around the other side? And like, we could say that stuff too, but I think I know what you're getting at. Like I had one shot and if I missed it, it was going
to
be bad.
I didn't know if you had to like prepare because obviously you haven't done that shot before. So I didn't know like what kind of settings you needed. If you had to like be switching out lenses in between, or like how the whole process went.
That's a really good question. So I had one camera because that's what they gave me and I didn't have anything else because that was, you know, I was using the school's gear still. And back then our camera that we were using it had a black and white monitor. So I had to make sure my color settings were proper. Like if I was in the wrong color temperature, you don't see that until you bring it back into the edit suite. Right. So there was that, and then it was like 4x3 garbage quality footage, like just not great. Like it's so sad when you think about it. Like it, you know, it could have been so much better, but yeah. So I definitely it was a different time. It wasn't film, obviously. It was different. Like it was tape.
Yeah.
But it was still. Now we have the luxury of like having these nice big monitors in front of us, full color.
Right.
What you see is what you're going to get and that type of thing. Or you can use different picture profiles so that you get a little bit more ability to fix things later, and didn't have any of that, you know? So yeah, to your point, like it was, a one shot deal. And I luckily did fine. So
that's great. So you get down from the helicopter. Are we just like pumped up as can be, or like how did you feel for the next couple of days?
No. Oh, actually, so I actually lied. I forgot this happened. So we went up one time. I almost threw up in the helicopter. Like the guy was whipping around all over the place. I didn't take a Gravol or anything. I had a winter coat on. Like it was like super hot. It wasn't because of me. I want to say it wasn't because of me that we didn't get what we needed, but it probably was, to be honest. but we ended up going up again. And then the second time I took a Gravol ahead of time.
Yeah.
I made sure I wasn't hot. I took all the stuff off, all that stuff. And the Gravol like made all the difference, but it was almost like a seasick feeling the first time. So yeah. So yeah, it wasn't smooth. It was not a smooth,
So we're done with that gig. Does the school keep hiring us back for other jobs, or we start freelancing on your own business stuff at that point?
Yeah, basically, yeah, the school didn't really. I worked with them a few times in the coming years after that, and then I've recently in the last. During the pandemic, I think it was the first year of the pandemic, I did a project for them again, much higher end. Really awesome to see like the, you know, 10 years, 12 years later, whatever, how much I've grown and how much things have changed. So that was neat. But yeah, I went from there and I started my own company and it was really small and it still is quite small, but it started small, just me freelancing. I ended up working on a reality TV show called Man Tracker. I don't know if you've heard of that, but
what's that about?
It's a guy on a horse, no joke. So the guy's on a horse chasing down the prey, which is two contestants. Over
that
the span.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's actually, it would be right up your alley. It's like an endurance type of thing, right? So they actually brought in a couple of like endurance I don't know what they used to call it. They weren't like Ironman competitions. They were like even bigger. They would be over days where they would have to like hike through all this
races and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they brought in like this Canadian guy. I think his name is Lance. I don't remember, but he was like a champion of that. And they basically brought him in to like help create the show, because otherwise how the hell are you going to do this? You have like people running through the woods from point A to point B over multiple nights and being chased by a horse. It was a crazy concept. But anyway, yeah, I worked on that for a little while as an editor and sort of got my start in the industry there. And and then, yeah, just over the years, I've just developed a pretty nice, substantial client list. And
growing. As far as editing for something like that, because I see a lot of movies these days and they're like, yeah, we finish up shooting and like in a year or two after we're done editing, like the movie will be out. So I imagine it's just hours and hours of going through footage. Is that what you experience or?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I was an assistant editor on that too. So my job was a lot of that, logging footage. At that time we were shooting on tape still. They were shooting on tape. I was shooting on tape on my project. So they take the tapes, capture the footage, which meant running it, digitizing it, which meant running it, playing it real time and running it through a computer. So that process alone, can you imagine how long that takes with like tapes and tapes and hours of tapes? And then once that's done, it is just hours and hours of trying to piece a story together, right? You can imagine how much footage can get captured. So to your point, it is similar. It's not the same time frame as a film, because film, there's so much more that goes into it, but it's a long, the editing process was the longest process.
So what did a typical day look like for you if you had a full day of editing?
So for me as the assistant editor, I would actually come in. I was at the bottom, like in because it was pretty small editing crew. Yeah. So I was at the bottom. So I'd come in once their days were done.
Okay.
And I would digitize, I would organize footage, I would print tapes, stuff like that, like send them for broadcast and stuff like that. The editors, they would come in the morning and just start, they would work with a story editor or story producer. So there's a lot more of that goes on that you don't really see, like, the editor is there. They're definitely there to provide their creative input. But a lot of the time when it comes to these reality shows, there's a story producer that's there.
Right.
Or a story editor who is going to try to create the drama and all that stuff. And they're going to tell the editor what to do, kind of thing. So it's a different, like once you get into that tier of production, there's so many more people involved. And the creative control, you lose more creative control. It disappears, like as an editor, say.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, I did a documentary last year, my own personal project, and I had full say over what's happening in that.
Very
right?
cool. Let's plug that. What was that?
Yeah, let's plug that. That's awesome. That was a good, that worked out just fine. I didn't mean for that to happen. So it's called John is for the Dogs. Okay. And it's, we're actually doing a launch party slash, I guess, a screening of it. June 26th here in town.
Okay.
But it will be available online either on that date or after. So, you know, whoever's anyone listening can stay tuned for that. But basically the whole premise is, this guy named John who travels to Manitoba, which is quite a distance from here. I think it's a just over 50-hour round trip to go to where he does and then coming back.
Always forget how big Canada is.
Canada's massive, man. It takes days to drive from. I did it. I did it with my wife. It's nuts. It's beautiful, but it's crazy.
Yeah.
To think how many countries you could visit in Europe, mm-hmm. just to go from one, you know, anyway. But anyway, he goes, he rescues dogs from northern reservations.
Okay.
And then he brings them back and distributes them to different rescue organizations, and then they will help find the dogs' homes. He brings cats too. And he works in tandem with one of his partners, Massimo, who also runs this organization. It's called Rough Riders Animal Transport. Plug for them. So yeah, so they just do amazing work. And we've got two dogs from Northern Reservations. And
okay.
you know, that means a lot. That work that they do means a lot to us. So so it was a completely, you know, personal project with no funding whatsoever that I really poured my heart into. And it took back to your point about editing. The editing was crazy. It's a 12-minute documentary, and I went through that thing like with a fine tooth comb. I just like I really, really took my time with it and took care with it. So so it's 12 minutes that I do not regret. It's awesome. I'm really happy.
For 12 minutes. How many hours of footage do you think you had?
I went lean on this because it didn't have a budget. Hmm. You know, I shouldn't say that I didn't want to take up too much of John's time, but that was a bit of a factor too. If it had a little bit more budget, I would have felt a little bit better about it. I would say I probably ended up with like 10 hours, maybe not quite, but a lot.
That's a lot.
You end up with a lot, like, because I would go and sit with him. You know, I did a car interview with him. That was an hour. I went and sat with him, did an interview. That was a couple hours. We went and did a drop off, mm-hmm. Where they, when they came back from Manitoba, they came and dropped the dogs off. That was a couple hours. So it could adds up quick. But I mean, that's the editor's dream and nightmare, right? Like mm-hmm. the editors need a lot to work with. And then when there's too much, it's like, man, it's going to take, you know, it's going to take forever to go through. But
yeah,
it's so always better to have more than less, right?
As far as rescuing from up north, is there, is it puppy mills? Like what's the issue with them up north? Can they just not come south, or what's going on there?
Good question. So yeah, we have a big issue in Canada with our indigenous I don't want to speak, you know, beyond my sort of knowledge in the area, but there's indigenous communities in Canada that still don't have clean drinking water, like a lot of them. And it's so far up north that it's pretty intense there's sometimes not even roads that will go up. You have to fly in, you know?
Wow.
And basically the problem is that, they're wild dogs. They're not like bred intentionally or anything like that. But they're absolutely wild. They're absolutely dangerous, to the communities. You know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. It's not all like puppies, cute puppies, right? Like people get attacked, kids get attacked because, dog may be in heat or whatever. So, it's a scary situation, and it's all just because there's no control, right? There's no spay and neutering that happens. They don't have that stuff like that. So, a lot of the initiative is to help control the population, like help them not be born, because mm-hmm. that's where the problems come from.
Yeah.
Not having the puppies is better than having to kill them. There's a lot of culling that goes on up there. you know, they'll just shoot the dogs. It's sad. It's really, really sad. Like our dog, our older dog is terrified of gunshots. She came as a pup. We got her as a puppy, but it's in her DNA. So either that or something happened when she was really, really small, you know? Right. So that's sort of the issue. Like I said, I'm not an expert. Like John has been up there so many times. He's the one to speak on all that stuff. But yeah, it's definitely an issue in Canada that needs to be addressed, not only with the animals, but with, you know, with the welfare of the humans too.
Right. So, oh, absolutely. Yeah. So you mentioned that you and your wife drove up there, and we've been talking a lot of photography. How did you meet your wife?
Yeah. So we met actually from school, but we didn't go to school together, oddly enough. Okay. My brother ended up taking an acting program at Niagara College, where I went as well. And he started the program the year after I graduated, and my wife started the program with him. And I was looking for an actor to be in a video, and ended up getting connected with her through my brother, and the rest is history, as they would say.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
As far as photography and opening your business, were you doing anything else other than just that passion? Because I know you mentioned like you still wanted to skate and stuff like that.
Yeah. You mean like for work or hobby?
So other than work, what else were you getting into?
Other than work at that time. Yeah, that was a shitty time for me in terms of like extracurricular stuff. I didn't have money because I just finished school. So I actually think back to those days, and there were moments like there were evenings where I would have a friend that would put up a pickup game. Like he'd rent the ice and we'd get to go. But yeah, that was it. And I would just, it's crazy to think of how much I like looked forward to those evenings and thinking like, well, why didn't I just join a men's league? But I didn't, because I didn't have the money, right? So soccer was gone for me, hockey was gone for me, all of those passions were gone. I still was active and athletic and stuff. I would rollerblade and jog and stuff like that. But in terms of all of those passions, yeah, they kind of disappeared. And sadly, it was because of money, which sucks. Yeah. But you know, it is what it is. So, yeah. So those moments weren't great for that. But then I met my wife. We only were together for like a year before we moved in together, and then we moved to the city. And then once we moved to the city, things started to, you know, expand and options started to open up. Right. And I could go, there was Shinny that was happening on Thursday nights that was run by, not by the city, but it was like $20 drop in. So it was no big like financial commitment. I could go spend $20 and get on the ice, you know? So it was kind of nice.
So as far as when you said things started to open back up or open, just expand, was that just you got more clients and stuff like that? Or what was expanding?
You know, just living in a city versus a small town, right?
Gotcha.
Opportunities open up, not really necessarily like from work, obviously, and it's a bigger market, and that's a whole other story. It's much more difficult in a bigger market, but just, you know, things are happening in the city. There's events, there's recreational things happening. You go to the city, like you can drop in on a program, whatever. So just that kind of stuff.
So nowadays, is there a specific medium that you like to work for, or like what kind of projects are you doing mostly?
Yeah, definitely what I like to do is not necessarily what I do for money. Age old problem, but I work with a lot of clients, which there I have great clients, but it's not really the stuff I want to be doing for the rest of my life. You know, I produce really high quality content, but really, and I tell other people's stories. When I say I tell other people's stories, I tell businesses' stories. I tell corporations' stories. I really want to tell stories that mean a lot to me, mean more to me. That's my goal, you know? So doing that John is for the Dogs documentary, that I could do 100 other projects to that one. And that's the one that's going to give me the feels, you know, and not just because of the content of it, but because it was a story that I wanted to tell, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the stuff that really gets me fired up is the idea of doing documentaries. That's my sort of goal going forward, is get more documentaries funded.
Gotcha. So when you say high quality content, obviously if you're doing it for the businesses and your clients and stuff like that, you're doing it for yourself. What does that mean to you? Because I see like an A-list movie and you know it's going to be shot well, stuff like this, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And then you start going like B, C, D. It's like, who shot this on their iPhone? And like who read through this script? Like, what's going on here?
That's so funny. I actually love watching some of those movies.
Oh, they're sometimes fantastic.
Yeah, like they're entertainment on their own. But I guess you're asking like from a technical perspective, like yeah, what's going on there? Well, there's a couple things. Like for one, the budget, typically a higher budget means you get to hire better people. That would be like rule number one, even when you're talking about indie productions, you know, mm-hmm, or even if you're talking about corporate productions, like stuff that I do. If I have a higher budget, I can hire better people and the product is going to be better and it's going mm-hmm to be stronger. Right. So that really applies to filmmaking as well. But then sometimes you get a flop and sometimes the filmmaker's vision just, it didn't come out the way that they thought it would, or it wasn't executed, or it resonates with them, but it doesn't resonate with the public or the general, like most people. From a technical perspective though, you're not wrong. Sometimes when you start to go down the list of the B to the C to the D, movies are not shot on high quality equipment, you know? And obviously it comes down to who is using the equipment, who knows, like, do they know how to use this get the most out of this camera? Like all that stuff. There's a whole lot that goes into it. But the big thing I think when it comes to any of those movies is you'll probably be more willing to not put as much value in the quality of the video and the quality of the audio if the story is good. If the story actually grips you, right? If the story keeps you engaged. If it doesn't do that, you got no hope. So really it comes down, like, storytelling is the most important thing, right? And then you need to have, like, I watch some of these movies, like they're awful. I don't know if you've ever heard of Neil Breen, but if you haven't, look up Neil Breen.
I'm terrible at names. Like if you describe something that he's done, maybe I've seen it, but like when you said there's that like wheels turning type of thing, I'm really good at like learning a lot of information as far as like math, science, concepts, and that's
good for you.
If it's music, artist, or like someone's name in reference to like a movie,
gone.
Not a chance. It's just gone.
At least you got the math and the science part, because I don't have that or the math or science. So you got me beat for sure. So the Neil Breen thing, he's like, okay, I don't want to shit on the guy, but there's something not quite right. Like he thinks he's making high end stuff, but it's very clear that he's not, you know, and he's like full of himself. And he made like a 5-hour documentary on himself as a filmmaker. And like a teaching, it's bizarre anyway. And you know, he'll put shots in his films that are like a 3-minute shot of someone walking down a street on Hollywood Boulevard. And it's like, that could have been 5 seconds. So point being is there's an emotional intelligence factor as well when it comes to filmmaking, that as you said, you start going down the line of the B, C, D, the emotional intelligence factor starts to disappear. Mm-hmm. And emotional intelligence is so crucially important when it comes to filmmaking. Yeah. I think it's crucially important with art, most art in general. But if you don't know what feels good, like not necessarily like a feel good thing. Should this be cut here because it's lingering too long? Like that's emotional intelligence, right? Like you should be able to feel like, oh, this is hanging too long. And then you watch these things and you're like, how did they not know that shot hung too long? Not by like a second, by like you know? So, yeah, like, I think to answer your question, that initial question, it's like, yeah, emotional intelligence. If you lack that, and I do teach that with, okay, with my, anyone that's trying to like do storytelling for a living, to be an editor, you have to have emotional intelligence, because understanding what pieces are going to resonate with people is the biggest part, right? Mm-hmm. And what pieces are going to resonate with your clients. But for example, I'll always like to end a video, to end a lame corporate video, I'll always ask a question like, what did you get out of this? Like, say someone's like doing a program, like a woodworking program.
Okay.
What do you get out of this? Like, what would you recommend to others who are thinking about joining this program? Oh, you know, I really think that anyone should join this program. It's turned my life around. Like, it's been a game changer for me. Like, that kind of stuff.
I'm sold.
Everyone wants to hear that, you know? So that's emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
People like you and I may take that stuff for granted, but not everyone has that, which right, may sound strange, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. So as far as like filmmaking and storytelling, the movies and shows and like social media, there's a lot of cuts. There's a lot of scene changes and things of that nature. Is that something that you see ever moving back? Because these cuts and scenes are getting pretty short. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think content, that's a really good question. I don't love the quick cut era. Like, yeah, it's not, and I'm talking about like TikTok and I'm thinking of that in my head as I say this. I don't love it. I think it does contribute to that ADD culture. Not to say that obviously people have ADD and whatever, and I think it's a diagnosable thing, but also I think due to what we consume, it's making it worse in a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I don't, and it's not my kind of content. I don't love it. Like, I disengage with that kind of stuff, though I'm guilty of making it myself. At times, because yeah, that's what the algorithm wants. Mm-hmm. Go figure. But yeah, but when it comes to, I mean, I think we all saw it on YouTube. It was, hey guys, blah, like you do your little intro, it's all snazzy and all that stuff. And then I saw, slowly but surely, I saw the calmer, like in my niche anyway, which is filmmaking cinematography, I saw the calmer guys start to come through.
Yes.
I saw like guys like Danny Gewurz. I'm going to toss out names, which I know you don't know, but Danny
Gewurz.
Yeah. he's a, you know, he's a cinematographer, whatever. He's chill. He's super chill. Like, yeah, he intentionally is chill. And that is what I gravitate towards. So I think that, yes, there is. And you mentioned films too. You mentioned like, so are you talking about flashy, like,
well,
quick?
Like when I watch a movie from 5, 10, 15 years ago, I feel like they'll have an extended scene. Like, it just doesn't seem like they're cutting back as fast. And now it's almost everything. Like, I'm counting it, and it's under 10 seconds and sometimes even less for a scene or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there's no doubt that our society dictates art and will dictate filmmaking. And we see that a lot with Netflix and with any, because there's so much data now,
right?
There's so much data that, and it's unfortunate in a way, because they can actually look at a show, say, and they can see exactly where people clicked out of it.
Gotcha.
And clicked onto something else. If we think that that isn't working its way into our art, we're completely mistaken. Like, that, it is 100%, because the producers will go to the production company, will go to the filmmakers, and that's how it works. So, do I think that it will change? If people want it to change, if people start consuming more content that is a little bit more chill, and the industry sees that people want that, then the content will change, then Hollywood will change and will adapt and everything.
Yeah.
if they see that people continue to want the quick pay, like, you know what I'm saying? It dictates, that will dictate how all of everything that we see is made.
Yeah. Well, I think it's similar to like fast food and things of that. Like it's not, we're not necessarily looking for like the best content out there. We're looking for a scientist that developed this chip to crunch properly to trigger something in your brain. So
exactly. 100%.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's hard to get away from that, as you can see with the Americans and fast food. So
you're not alone. we've got it here too. The difference here is actually it's very expensive, and okay. And I don't hate that.
Yeah.
It's so cheap for you guys, and it's mm-hmm. so accessible. It's accessible for us too, but yeah. not accessible financially. Like, I don't know if I were to go, first of all, I'm a vegetarian, so I really don't eat McDonald's and stuff like that.
Okay.
But if I were to go to McDonald's and buy like a Big Mac meal here, it's going to cost like $13.
Okay.
It's not a joke, man. Like, for sure. Yeah. It's, I think for two people, you're with tax and everything, it's about $30.
Wow.
Yeah. Not kidding. Not kidding at all. So that's, how different is that? Like, how much is a Big Mac meal for you?
I stick to the dollar menu if I go. So
we don't have a dollar menu. That's it.
Well, so it used to be a dollar menu. Now it's a value menu. It's like $2, $3, right. Whatever it is.
Right, right.
Yeah. So if I happen to find myself there at a weak moment, it's like the dollar McChicken or McDouble is no longer this cheap price.
Right.
But so you mentioned that you're a vegetarian. Where did that come in?
That was, you know, I'm a big animal person, as you could probably tell from our convo. And, I stopped eating. I got to know some cows and I stopped eating beef. And then that was like 15 years ago, probably. And then, I met my wife, she was vegetarian, fully vegetarian. So we just started cooking together. It was easier to cook vegetarian. Yeah. And I just ended up switching. For a couple of years, I still ate like chicken once in a while and stuff. I'm a terrible vegetarian. I still eat fish from time to time.
Yeah.
So don't shoot me, hardcore vegetarians, but like, I don't care like that, you know, like, and like I eat dairy, I eat eggs every morning. So, you know, it's vegetarian. So it's not a problem, but, yeah, it's been probably 12, 13 years, I think, now that I've been primarily vegetarian. Like I said, a bad one at times, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I have a wide variety of people on here. I have some people that it's just steak and salt, and then I have some that are vegetarians, and I ask them both the same question. What would you need to hear, or what would change you to kind of switch over and possibly try out to just the opposite of what you're doing now?
I would probably overnight change. It has actually nothing to do with diet for me. I actually think that I would prefer to eat meat at times, because there is I've tried bulking at times in my past, you know, working out more, lifting weights. And it was really hard. I had a hard time with it, trying to get the right level of protein in without like going crazy on shakes and stuff. It would, for me, what it would take, I already know the answer. Personally, I'd need to kill the animal. That's my, that's my personal rule. So if I could ever bring myself to go and like, you know, go fishing, kill the fish, gut the fish, whatever, that's sort of my personal rule. And I'm probably a weird vegetarian in this way, like in that way, where like, there's part of me that wonders if I'm missing something. Like, I ate meat my whole childhood, so it's not like I'm, you know, it's like I haven't done it or something.
Right.
Part of me is always curious if I'm, I look at people that do kill their own food and eat it. And I wonder if I'm missing something in life with that, you know, like I can't help but wonder if that's like same with kids. I don't have kids. I have that same wonder in life. Yeah. Like, what am I missing here? Like, I won't know what it's like to have my own child, you know? So I have that thing in the back of my head. So I don't know, maybe there may be a point in my life where I can bring myself to kill an animal and eat it again.
Yeah.
I think it would be fish first if I had to, because I feel like there's such an abundance of them. Like, I don't know.
And I've been told that they don't feel pain. I don't know if that's true or not.
I want to believe that too. Yeah. So
that's what I'll go with.
That's what I'll go with too. And yeah. So, yeah, that's my plan. If I do see myself probably doing that at some point, and I will enjoy that fish. But I'll tell you, my problem is now, like recently, not recently, but you know, half a year ago, we were in the East Coast of Canada, and they didn't really have any vegetarian options. They had like a pasta dish, and my wife got it. And I was like, I'm not paying $25 for more shitty noodles. There was like nothing even on it. It was like butter and noodles or something. So, I mean, it wasn't that bad, but it was basically that. And so I'm like, I'm going to get the fish and chips. Like, fuck it. I don't care.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I felt guilty. Like, I don't know. It's been so long that now I was looking at the plate. I'm like, I feel bad about this. And not bad that I did it. Not bad because of some persona. Bad because I feel bad for the fish and that I didn't kill it and yada, yada, yada. It's just this whole thing, this whole thought process that I have. So that's my sort of answer. I really do hope that I can get there someday, because I think it would be a cool thing to do.
Yeah, I agree. We do have a soft out, so we'll finish up with the last two questions.
Oh yes, sorry, I didn't. This has been going flying by. Holy shit! Having fun, man.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as health goes, what's the definition of health for you? Not necessarily the dictionary definition, but what do you strive for?
Good. That's a great question. I think I want to be able to be mobile until I'm an old man, you know?
Oh, love it.
Fingers crossed that I can get there. So I always want to be able to walk my dogs, you know? I don't want to have to pay someone to do that. And I want to be able to do that until I'm 80 or however old I am. So really that's what it comes down to for me. I want to be able to stay active my whole life. I want to, you know, I'm 36 and I'm already realizing like, yeah, I get pains when I used to not. Like my back after I play hockey now is like, what did you just do to me? You know? So I know that there may be a time when I, you know, 15, 20 years from now where I can't even play those sports that I love anymore, but that's okay if I can still just live a regular life, you know, if I can still get out there, go for a hike. I see people, we hike all the time. I see older people out there. I'm like, that's me. Yep. I want to be you, you know? So it comes down to mobility and for me and, you know, just living. It's not that I want to live forever. It's not that I want to live to be 100. I just want to live comfortably for as many years as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And then what's something in your life that somebody listening to the podcast would be able to take away as a positive?
Don't listen to this. Don't listen to anything I say. That's the best thing you can do. I think back to what I was saying earlier, treat everyone with respect, with, you know, be as happy as you can. Just spread kindness, be as kind as you can to as many people as you can. That's going to make you be a happier person, I think. Mm-hmm. And don't take life seriously at the same time. Like, do that as much as you can. And then be a good person. Be a good person without taking life too seriously, you know? Because I feel like there's so many people that are trying to be a good person, and they're trying to be a good person by shitting on other people. Like, you're trying to be a good vegan, say, for example, trying to be a good vegan because you want to save animals, but now you're screaming at another person. It doesn't really help, you know? Yeah. So, like, that's just a bad example, but, you know, that applies everywhere in life. So I just think that if we all try to, like, look at what you're doing, you know, coming on, connecting to a person you've never talked to before. Like, I love it. That's what I do on my podcast too. Being on TikTok, building a community online, building a community in your area, all of that stuff. That's what I think that we need more of. And that if you just focus on being happy, it's not going to work. You know, you have to do things in your life that are going to contribute to that. And I think that connecting with people and being a decent human are just those two things. And then with that, at the end of that, don't take it too seriously. Don't take life too seriously. Don't take any of that too seriously either. That's my advice from someone who doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. So,
I love it. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, buddy. It was really nice chatting with you.
Yeah.